The job of the blender is to combine these elements in such a way as to produce an overall flavour.
A wider repertoire of different beverages than ever before.
I think one of the most interesting breweries, and certainly one of the most interesting origin stories for a brewery in Australia.
Single malts, blends, grain whiskies, bourbons and more.
If you want mezcal to be sold around the world, then unfortunately you're going to have to make a compromise.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. It's great to be back with you for season 11 of the Drinks Adventures podcast. At some point last season, we powered past episode number 100, and I had intended to mark that occasion in some way, possibly even with a live event, but as Sydney slid into lockdown again, it became obvious that wasn't going to happen, and it seemed to make more sense just to forge ahead and save the celebrations for a later date. So here we are. And with Christmas just around the corner, there's been some awesome drinks books hitting the market, like the second edition of The Beer Bible by Jeff Allworth, who joins us today on the show. Jeff is a multi-award-winning beer writer living in one of my favourite cities, Portland, Oregon, an absolute mecca for craft beer. His books have been cited on two occasions as best book by the North American Guild of Beer Writers. And in 2016, the first edition of The Beer Bible was named Best Drinks Book by the International Association of Culinary Professionals. Jeff also writes the Beervana blog and co-hosts the Beervana podcast, where he and Oregon State University economics professor Patrick Emerson discuss beer and the economics of beer. Now, I figure some of you may be unfamiliar with Jeff's previous work, so I started by asking him, what is the Beer Bible?
The Beer Bible is a reference guide to beer. It's 230,000 words, which doesn't mean anything to writers, but it's over 600 pages. And my kind of guiding light when I put it together was to answer any reasonable question a person might have about beer, whether it's a brand new person coming into beer or somebody who wants a technical question, like Vienna Lager, when was it first brewed, or is there Munich malt in a Bock, or something like that. It should answer all those questions. That was sort of my goal.
Now, I guess I'm going to ask the question that you said is a pretty popular question for journalists to ask you about the new edition. How much has beer changed in the last 8 years that it warrants a new edition of the Beer Bible?
Yeah, it's a really good question. When I wrote the first edition, I assumed it would be, I tried to write it to be evergreen, in fact, and I assumed it would be. I thought,
That's probably a bit naive in hindsight.
Yes, it really was. But I did think, if we step back a little bit and think about beer in a more general sense, not try to cover every release or think about every micro style that might have come out, can we cover it in a way that it'll be relevant for a decade? And I thought the answer would be yes. I think if I'd written it at any other time, that would have been a pretty good bet, because beer, it changes quickly in one way when you think about, breweries releasing new beers, but it changes pretty slowly in other ways. But what I didn't really appreciate was how much the American tradition, which was being born at the time I was publishing the first edition, would begin to transform beer worldwide. And I'm talking about the hoppy ales that Americans developed as a way of working with our incredibly aggressive and vibrant hops, so that they weren't just super bitter, which for many years that's how we brewed beer, and that instead they produced this kind of rich, expressive hop flavor and aroma. And now that style that we've developed has become fairly ubiquitous around the world. And it really picked up and changed and became this whole new national tradition sort of at the moment I published the first edition. And so the phrase hazy IPA, for example, does not appear in that book, and many other features of modern IPA culture. So that, given that it is the most popular style in the craft world right now, and it's the one that I think most people will look to, especially in other countries outside the U.S., to find out what Americans are doing and what that style is all about, they'll find fairly old information in the first edition. So I reworked all the American stuff, which meant dumping, I think, three chapters and reworking them into one chapter. And that was the impetus. And then if you're going to get under the hood, you might as well, you know, fix a few other things that might be getting a little dog-eared along the way, to mix two metaphors.
So it's mainly in the US where things have changed so significantly over the last 8 years. Has things been much more stable in the old world?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, since I published the first edition, the Germans have declared that it's okay to dry hop, according to Reinheitsgebot. And, you know, if you go to London now, the cask ale that you get is made with Citra and Mosaic. You know, it's very juicy. I think in your neck of the woods, you find a lot of hoppy beers that are, you know, follow sort of the general contours of the United States. And now what we're seeing, and I think New Zealand and Australia and South Africa are really leading the way here, is a development of a whole new hop industry and, you know, new kinds of hops that are perfectly designed in the expressivity for these kinds of beer. So even when you look at the ingredient side, it's changing worldwide. And now, in France and Austria, or I guess it's actually Slovenia, it's in the Styrian region, and other places, people are trying to grow these same kind of IPA style hops. So it's fairly international. And, you know, if you go to any place where beer is brewed, you'll find people making these kinds of beers, which, you know, 15 years ago basically didn't exist. So it's a fairly radical transformation in the beer world.
And you kind of likened it to the significance of decoction mashing or cask conditioning or secondary fermentation in Belgian brewing, in terms of the sort of level of impact that it's had on beer styles and, you know, obviously in such a small amount of time compared to those other techniques.
Yeah. When I wrote the first edition, I had the enormous fortune to go travel through Europe, particularly where the original styles that, you know, are most popular in the world right now came from. And going country to country in a short period of time was illuminating, in the sense that people talked about beer very similarly, irrespective of the styles they were brewing in a particular country, but very differently from country to country. So if you go from the UK and listen to people talk about how they think about beer there and how they make beer, and then you go to Belgium, you see this kind of radical shift in thinking. And those are two really, you know, they're very close together, and they both make traditional ales, and they think about them very differently. And then, of course, if you go to Germany, it's another whole thing. And what it made me realize is, I think everybody gets on one level that beer is cultural. It's a cultural manifestation. The way we think about beer and the kinds of beers we brew reflect the way we think about beer in that country and the way people drink beer and what they prefer. But to actually see it side by side over and over again and see how brewers thought about that was very enlightening. And I didn't, you know, because I come from America, I hadn't put America under the same microscope that I was putting these other countries. And I think I didn't really realize that the way Americans were starting to brew beer was as weird and unusual to other countries as the way Belgians brew is to the British or the Germans. But then, you know, by the time it came time to write the second edition, that was much clearer to me, that framework of national tradition of the way people think about beer was really clear. And when you think about those older traditions and when they were born, what happened, you know, you could see that in some cases they had worldwide impact. In the 18th century and 19th century, the British production of porter went around the world, and people started making versions of porter, and then, you know, everywhere around the world, and those things would either become indigenous styles, or, you know, in some cases, they only survived for a few decades before they winked out. And then we saw the same thing with light lagers out of Austria and Czech Republic or Bohemia, which was kind of the same country at the time, a century later. And those again went around the world. And now with IPAs, you know, if you go to the Czech Republic, you'll find people drinking IPAs, in much the same way that a century and a half ago, people in the United States were drinking Bohemian lager. So it's a kind of return to an old pattern, but one we haven't seen in a long time.
And IPAs, we should clarify, are IPAs.
Right. Yeah. In many places, they call IPAs IPAs, which I love because what Americans are doing have nothing to do with what the Brits did centuries ago. And so trying to refer it to India Pale Ale by the time it's an American style just is bizarre. So IPA is actually probably a better way to call these beers anyway.
Now, you said, you know, you wrote a piece on your Beervana blog just talking about some of the most significant changes in the book. And you talked about how a bunch of styles that you included in the American Ales chapter last time around have mostly died out. Maybe you could talk about which styles they were.
Yeah, it's been an interesting kind of transformation to watch in my own lifetime because I'm now starting to be kind of a long in the tooth guy. I started drinking beer in the late 1980s when craft brewing was just getting going. And if you had gone to a brewery, if we could teleport back in time and go to a brewery here in Portland, for example, where I live, in 1989, the first year I was drinking beer, you'd find an amber ale, maybe a red ale. You'd find a porter. You'd find a stout. You'd probably find a thing called a golden ale, which was really just an ale version of Budweiser. And you'd probably find a pale ale, and that pale ale would look a lot less like an English pale ale than it would Sierra Nevada, which by that time was already becoming fairly established. So, you know, and wheat, that was another big one, wheat ales, which were not like Bavarian wheat beers, but they were much more neutral. They were like American pale ales made with a lot of wheat and low hop character. Those were also incredibly popular. So basically all of those styles have kind of faded out. And partly they faded out because we have better ingredients. At the time in the United States, there was one base malt. It was produced for making domestic lager. It had no character at all. There were very few flavor malts that you could use. So people were chunking these beers together with not very many malts. There weren't even very many hops. I remember talking not too long ago to John Harris, who's a brewer here in Oregon, and he was the founding brewer at Deschutes, and that was his second brewery, so he's been around for a long time. And he remembers
it's Ecliptic is his brewery now.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's impressive. Good for you to know that.
I know my Portland beer pretty well. We might get onto that a bit later on.
That's fantastic. Yeah, he's an icon in town. And he was talking about brewing and how the limited number of ingredients he had, and he was brewing with cluster hops still. There were so few hops that he was brewing with cluster hops, which is just remarkable. So there were these kind of transitional styles as Americans were learning to brew with ale yeast. You know, they were mostly very caramely, very sweet, They were brewed by people who didn't really understand the style that they were imitating, and they were being brewed for people who didn't have sophisticated flavor palettes yet. And so as we kind of grew as a country and people got more sophisticated, those beers got refined and most of them went away. And the way we brewed with malts that weren't very characterful, a lot of caramel malt, very neutral yeasts, and not super amount, you know, not a lot of hops. All of that has shifted, and now we've become much more hops focused, and no caramel malt to speak of, and more interest in yeast expressivity and a bunch of other stuff. So it's really changed in the 30 years I've been drinking beer.
So should we be mourning the loss of these beer styles, or they really were just sort of transitional beer styles that helped the American craft brewers kind of find their feet and create more expressive styles?
I personally only mourn one of them, and I know others. There's especially in my neck of the woods, there's a kind of warmth and fondness for amber ales, which I don't share too much. I think, you know, if you look at the history of beer going back hundreds of years, you see that styles come and go constantly. It's really common for people to try something new and do some weird thing, and for whatever reason it's popular for a minute and then it fades. So that's actually, I don't think, anything to mourn so much. If the style is really tasty, then that's worth mourning. And in the case of sessionable, 5.5% porters, you can't find those in the United States very much at all anymore. And that is one of my favorite styles. And I really lament that it used to be that you could walk into any brew pub and they would all have a porter. And I would love that to be the case now. I do lament that.
It's just not fashionable anymore.
It's just not fashionable. People do not like dark beers. So it's hard. It's a hard sell.
Yeah, for sure. And speaking globally, outside of the US, which other styles are closest to extinction?
Well, in the book, I had a chapter on brown ales and I had a chapter on milds, two styles which are not doing well. They're on life support, so I combined those. They're fairly similar, and it was hard for me to justify having two chapters. And it's interesting. I had wit beer as its own chapter. And in the United States, we have a mass market product from Miller Coors called Blue Moon, which probably many people have heard of. And it's a wit beer. And you know, it made that style one of the most popular styles in America. But it's not particularly distinctive. It's not that different from other Belgian styles. And I have a whole chapter on Belgian ale where I kind of round up a few styles that are variations on a theme. And I thought, I don't really know that we need to have a whole wit beer style. So I eliminated that one too. That might be slightly more controversial.
And the brewery profiles are a big part of the book as well, where you kind of focus on particular breweries that are the exemplars of particular beer styles in their area. Tell me about, you know, the considerations this time around when it came to changing up some of those players.
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. That is maybe my favorite part of the book, because I had the chance to visit these breweries and fell in love with them, and it became a formative way for me to understand beer. I think we always talk about style as this guideline that everybody follows. And in fact, style is sort of a weird modern invention. You know, we would have really thought of typicality in terms of, is this a kind of beer? Like Guinness is a good example. It was such a dominant producer of a particular type of beer that it became, you know, it's just, if you want to understand that style, you kind of have to reconcile Guinness Brewery. You know, it's a really big deal. Saison DuPont, in terms of Saison, the DuPont Brewery is another good example of a brewery that's so titanic in importance that it's hard to overlook. So I think at one time we might have thought of looking at breweries rather than styles. So when I got to visit these breweries and listen to people who in many cases really focused on a particular beer that they make, not in every case exclusively, but overwhelmingly, in which they had made for decades, I learned something really different about the way you think about a beer at a brewery like that. So all of that is a lead up into why I have those chapters at all. I think it's important to listen to the brewers who are making those talk about them. So I threw those in there. And, you know, there are a lot of great breweries out there. So I tried to shift as many as I could to include new breweries. It was not a demotion to move other breweries out, just a way of trying to offer a little bit more interest. And also, I think I would love people to visit more breweries and talk to more brewers, whether you're really deeply into beer or just coming to it, you know, immediately. So I hope those offer an inducement for people to you know, email ahead and say, hey, I'm going to be here. Can you show me around, or do you have a public tour or whatever? Get into the brew house and talk to brewers if you can, because it's a whole lot of fun and you learn a huge amount about beer if you do that. So those exist as a way of doing that. And I shifted as many as I could. There were a few, like DuPont is a good example. With Saison, it was really difficult to imagine moving them out of that role. They're such a pivotal brewery. It got down to being just two Saison breweries left on the planet, and they were by far the most important, I think. So I left them, but I switched others out. For example, I was, even before I wrote this, I had wished I had done put Harvey's in there as a profile. So that was a major focus of this book. I thought I'm definitely going to do another research trip to Europe, and I'm definitely going to Harvey's because I wanted to write about Harvey's. So I got back, and that was a sublime experience. Miles Jenner is one of the great old gentleman brewers of the UK, and I had a wonderful time there, and it's definitely a brewery everybody should know about. So it's fun to write those and shine a little spotlight on these just really amazing breweries.
It sounds like you were pretty lucky to get some travel in to work on this book just before all the shit went down last year.
Oh, man, I had no idea. Yeah, I got back early November 2019. And yeah, nobody had any idea. If I had waited a year, you know, for publications, you never know, it could have taken longer to get the contract signed and get going. Yeah, I would have had to delay the book. I don't think I could have. I wouldn't have felt good about rewriting it without traveling again. You know, one thing I wanted to do is the great work of Lars Garshall, the blogger and now author who, sort of uncovered for English speakers this world of Baltic and Scandinavian brewing. That I felt like I really had to go and witness some of that. So I went to Lithuania to taste some of that beer. You know, I feel like you can't write a book that's called the Beer Bible from your desk in Portland, Oregon. You got to get out and see the world and talk to people and get a sense of this stuff. So you're right. If I would have been totally hosed if I'd waited very much longer.
Maybe tell us a little bit more about that really interesting farmhouse ale scene in the Baltics and Scandinavia, because that was certainly one of the topic areas that where I just sort of thought to myself, wow, well, I haven't heard anything about that before.
Yeah. I mean, I want to give it all up to Lars. He's done such great work. You know, he's a computer guy who lives in Norway somewhere. I should know where. and he was a beer geek, and he just started traveling around. And actually, I think the first place that something shifted in his mind was when he went to Vilnius, or he went to Lithuania, and he tasted the beer there. And I experienced this myself. It's a very weird beer, and it's. All of the beer, even the lagers that are made at larger regional breweries in Lithuania, the beer just has a very different palate. And that comes up from this farmhouse tradition. And that piqued his interest. And he started poking around and he realized that Lithuania, to a lesser extent, Latvia, and then Norway. And many people understood that there was a Finnish version called Sati, but it turns out there's versions of that in many of the countries of the region. And so he just started traveling to farmhouses where this stuff was not even commercially available. It was just people making it at home in pretty large homebrew batches and maybe sharing with other people around the farm, but not commercially available. And his work is a kind of beery ethnology that I think is the most important work that anyone's done in beer writing and, you know, I don't know, forever. It's just amazing. And so I don't think it will be useful for the readers of my book if I go to a farmer, to one of these farmers in Norway, though I would have loved to do that. But Lithuania, you know, Vilnius, if you walk into a pub and you taste the beer there, you definitely taste something unusual. And you know, Lars tipped me off to that, so I definitely wanted to go to Vilnius and try the beer. Now, when people ask me the question, which they had asked when the last time the book came out, people said, "What? Where should we go?" That you know, people, it's kind of unexpected. And I always say the Czech Republic because the beer scene there is way more varied than you imagine. It's not just pilsners. Now I say go to Vilnius. I doubt very few people will take me up on it, or I assume very few people will take me up on it. But you should still go to Vilnius. It's awesome.
And what are the key factors at play that are resulting in these different flavor outcomes?
In Lithuanian beer?
Yeah, in those local beers, yeah.
Well, with Lithuania, it's amazing. So they have local malts, and the farmers have these different brewing methods, which the most exotic of which is where they mash the grain and then they put it in these big pans and bake it. Which caramelizes the malt. They also do there's an older tradition of stone brewing, which is another caramelization of the malt. And I think these processes created a kind of expectation that beer would be dark, but it wouldn't be roasty. It would be caramelized. And so the palate of Lithuanian beer has an incredibly sweet note, whether it's a pale beer or a dark beer. And it often has a touch of isoamyl acetate, so the banana, or even a little bit of diacetyl or both, but not a huge amount, just enough to kind of sweeten it up. And then the malts are really unusual because the dark malts are much more berry-like and sweet than roasty. And the pale malts are very unusual too. The pale malts kind of have a dry cracker quality. So all of that has filtered up. So I think I write about this in the book, one of the moments, it was cool to taste the farmhouse beers, which you can get in Vilnius. And there's a style called raw ale where the beer is not boiled. It goes straight from the mash to fermentation. And you know, you're getting to taste these beers and it's really interesting and cool. But then at the end of my trip, I went and bought a couple of bottles from a local producer of lager, two different versions of light lager that they made. And those flavors were still in the beer. They didn't taste anything like lagers at all. And that's when I realized, oh, this is a tradition that is so entrenched and so, you know, such a big part of the way people in Lithuania think about beer, that if you're making these other styles, sort of like, you know, when the Belgians brewed Scotch ale, and I'm doing air quotes here, it didn't taste anything at all like a Scottish ale. It tasted like Belgian ale because they used their crazy yeasts on it, and they did, you know, they thought like Belgians. The Lithuanians have the same thing. And so the beer, whether it's straight off the farmhouse or, you know, from the 300,000 barrel brewery that makes lagers, has an incredibly distinctive flavor profile that is unlike anything outside of Lithuania. So it's really fun to go there and try those beers.
Now, this edition also gets a chapter devoted to one of the oldest and most interesting styles of beer, which is sake. Tell me about the deliberations as to whether sake should be part of this book.
Yeah, I felt that was the one regret I had the second that the first edition was published, is that I didn't include sake as a full-on chapter of a style, and I honestly don't know why I didn't, but it was, you know, I mentioned it as a kind of lesser-known style in a catch-all chapter of more traditional beers. But the truth is, it's one of the oldest traditions of brewing in the world, and it's definitely a beer. It's a grain. Humans have been making beer for 12,000 years wherever the grain grows, and in Japan, the grain that they have is rice, and so they figured out a way to brew with it that's very unusual because rice is an unusual grain. In the interim, I learned a lot more about sake, and it's a very cool tradition. And I think because we don't tend to think of sake as a beer, we think, you know, it's often described as a rice wine, and it tastes more wine-like in many ways. It just kind of gets left out of the discussion. But indeed, it is a really important beer style. And for somebody who thinks about beer through the lens of culture like I do, it's an incredibly interesting cultural artifact as well, and really one that everybody should know about. And, you know, just beer people should know about some of the weird stuff that's going on with that style of beer. For example, the standard yeasts that they pitch will ferment their sake up to 20%, which is, you know, enormously stronger than any beer that you get in Europe or the United States. And as I was, you know, I don't know, for the first, until I really thought deeply about sake, I was on the same page as everyone else who said that Saccharomyces, you know, couldn't ferment beer that strong. So, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of lessons when you dig into these other traditions and see different ways of thinking about beer and brewing beer, you learn a whole lot. So I hope people, whether they are interested in sake, to drink it all that much, I think you should, you know, taste it, learn about it, understand the tradition, and you'll have a deepened sense of beer writ large.
Well, look, while I've got you there, maybe you could just give us a bit of an overview. How's the beer scene looking in Portland at the moment? Are breweries recovering from the pandemic's impacts, or are you kind of predicting there's going to be some pretty tough times ahead over the next little while?
Well, I can tell you what's happened. I'm a little bit more reluctant to say what will happen because COVID has proven to be unpredictable. But Portland's done pretty well. I think American craft brewing in general has done fairly well. And I think in some ways, Portland may have been a little bit more well-positioned. Well, in some ways, it was less positioned. We drink more beer on draft here than other places. So, once draft went away, that was a challenge for brewers. But the way in which we have a bigger advantage is a lot of the brewers we have are more mature and have a big fan base. And so when COVID hit, the brewers scrambled and started packaging it, trying to make it available. Many started delivering and just reaching out and appealing to their fans, come buy our beer, keep us in business. And the fans who, are in love with Portland breweries responded and for the most part kept them going. And I think we lost one or two, and it's not totally obvious to me that they wouldn't have failed anyway. So, yeah, so I think things are great here. I'm sensing more lightheartedness. Even at the start of summer, when it looked like things were going to be better, it was still kind of dark. One of the brewers in town that I know pretty well said, I got into this business and I didn't mind hard work. I didn't mind working, especially when we started the brewery, 6 days a week and 12 hours a day, because, I was doing what I loved, and I would walk out at the end of my shift, I'd walk out into my tap room where people were enjoying my beer, and I'd have a pint with people, and it was really joyful. And that's the whole reason I got into it. And, we're surviving through COVID. We're going to be fine, but man, it's just not fun. And I didn't get into this business for this.
Yeah.
And I think that just reflected perfectly the sense of things. Even at the start of summer, it felt like we were still not really finding the joy. And I do think, even though COVID lingers and we don't have the same kind of pub culture that we had before COVID, people are kind of falling back into it. We just are coming through the end of fresh hop season here in Portland and in Oregon, which is the most joyful time of our calendar, because we're located right next to the hop fields, and most breweries will do at least one, and many do many different fresh hop beers, go out to the fields, grab some hops, throw them in the beer, and that creates all this excitement among fans who roam around in packs trying to find the freshest of the fresh hop beer, and talking about it on social media and enjoying it, and that's always a really fun time. So that's been good, and I think we feel like maybe even if COVID does come roaring back, maybe we're a little bit ready to just deal with life the way it is and enjoy beer again. It feels like maybe things are happier.
Fantastic. Well, Jeff, that sounds like a good note to end on. So congratulations on the new edition of the Beer Bible. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Well, I want to thank you too. And I know you and I, trying to figure out a time with the time zones and me on tour has been challenging. And you persevered, and I really appreciate that.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.